Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The Wisconsin Elections Commission and the City of Madison argue over changes after a Madison clerk lost hundreds of ballots last November. Plus, tribal and environmental groups are again challenging a pipeline in northern Wisconsin. And flooding sparked a state of emergency as communities brace for a long cleanup. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for August 15th. I'm Anya Van Wagenendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. We have an exciting week of news to reflect on, including something that kind of just wrapped up moments ago, which was a special meeting of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. This is kind of continued fallout from this incident this past November where the Madison city clerk did not notice that 193 ballots had gone missing. WEC has taken action. And then this past week, there has been a little bit of an argument between Madison city attorney Mike Haas and the Wisconsin Elections Commission. So this is a special meeting kind of dealing with some of that back and forth. So earlier this week, Mike Haas sent a letter saying essentially that WEC was trying to micromanage his office, that all communities should have to follow the same directives, sort of responding to WEC finding that this clerk had violated the tenets of her job, recommending a series of changes. He said, regardless of whether there's still an opportunity to fix the error, and there is not, Commission's authority does not extend to requiring the future implementation of specific procedures in excess of those required in the statutes. And WEC responded, staff attorney Angela O'Brien Sharp, saying that they're not trying to micromanage the administration of elections, but when an incident occurs that is as serious as what happened in the city of Madison, the Commission must have the ability to intervene and take specific steps to correct unlawful actions and improper exercise of discretion. So kind of a battle of multi-page memos going back and forth. And then this meeting this morning, what happened?
So look, for all the drama between the attorneys, it was kind of drama-free. The commission voted 5-1 to require Mass to take these steps. I mean, their directives on training, basically they identified all these issues that happened with the missing of the absentee ballots from November, how to make sure it doesn't happen again. The interesting about the back and forth between Haas and the other attorneys with WEC is that Haas used to be the WEC administrator. So he is saying, you guys don't have the authority. When I signed all these orders back in my day, my 12 years at the agency, this, and this. And the response was, well, wait a second. We looked through the record. We couldn't find any support your argument. And it's ludicrous and absurd, I think, to suggest we can't tell Madison how to fix things. So again, for all the drama and the back and forth, not much drama in the hearing today, in which they said, okay, Madison, you now have these new rules you have to follow, or directives to follow, make sure this doesn't happen again. Couple of things, examples. For example, poll books. All right, so you go vote, you sign the poll book, so they know that you're there. There are watermarks in poll books when they're printed to show that your absentee ballot already came back. So if I voted absentee and I show up at the poll, they go, wait a second, I have your ballot. Part of the problem last November was that Madison, when it printed its poll books quite early, they had to go back in by hand and add in people who had voted absentee already. Some of that stuff was missed. It wasn't prominent enough, arguments like that. The commission is saying, look, you have a deadline now. You can print no earlier than this to make sure you get as many people as possible. There's watermarks. You have to go back by hand and fix stuff going forward. So a lot of nitty-gritty stuff, but there are things just for Madison to fix this going forward.
And so, yeah, so they voted to kind of send out a compliance order. And so there is still a little bit of room for Madison to push back. And so I think this will continue to kind of unfold over the next couple of weeks. It seems like every few weeks we have some WEC news to talk about. Also this week there was a hearing on Line 5. That is this oil and gas pipeline from Superior out to Canada. And it's been sort of a subject of some controversy over the last many years. It's the company is Enbridge, and they essentially are facing a deadline of June of next year to reroute this pipeline around the Bad River Bend of Lake Superior Chippewa Reservation. So that in itself was its own long process. And so now this hearing this week was about the process of rerouting it. So essentially, tribal representatives and environmental representatives are saying that the DNR permits that were issued in this rerouting process are illegitimate. So they're arguing that it didn't go through the right sort of standards. It doesn't follow regulations about making sure that the pipeline and the rerouting process won't affect wetlands, can adequately filter pollutants and hold back floodwater. So basically that it just didn't go through the standard regulation process for making sure that a pipeline project can go through. This is also a sort of interesting administrative thing. So they're kind of going up against the DNR in a contested case hearing, which is different than the kind of lawsuits that we've seen accompanying this project for a long time. And so regardless of what happens there, I expect that this is going to get appealed and, like many things these days, probably up to the state Supreme Court. And so we'll kind of see what some of these, you know, multi-county and tribal versus state kind of concerns, where that plays out.
Yeah. So it'd be a court fight in the end, so I can tell you for sure.
It's always a court fight in the end, so that'll be really interesting to keep an eye on. Also this week, we have a new Democrat in the race for Wisconsin's first congressional district. That is that stretch of southeastern Wisconsin that's Kenosha, Racine, Janesville, Beloit, all the kind of land in between. Brian Stile has represented it. He just won his fourth reelection campaign, and it's been in Republican hands for 30 years, but Democrats have really had their eye on it for quite some time. So this week, Mitchell Berman threw his hat in the ring. He joins Randy Brice, who last tried to win it from Paul Ryan, and then it became not Paul Ryan and became Brian Stile was his opponent in 2018. And then Gage Stills, a Racine activist. Who is this guy? Who is Mitchell Berman, who announced this week?
Good question, because people I talk to don't really know who he is. Now, if you look big picture at what Democrats are doing nationally, they're looking for people who can talk about the big, beautiful bill, one big, beautiful bill, and talk about the healthcare impacts, you know, Medicaid, those kinds of things. So in that regard, he kind of fits that profile. He's an emergency room nurse, been a VA the last decade, I believe his campaign says. Beyond that, though, he's got much of a profile. He's been active in local politics with the Raymond School District. He sued the board over some open meetings violations. There was a settlement in 2024 or something like that. But he's not a household name anywhere in Wisconsin that I can find. So the question from, like anybody, is can you raise the money and raise your profile to be a legitimate contender? Now, Randy Brice was a money machine in 2018. Unbelievable amount of money raised, like $8 million plus. That machine has dried up so far. We saw one report from him. It was not impressive. So it's kind of questionable if he's running a serious campaign at this point for the district. I don't know Mr. Sills at all, what his background is. Kind of not high profile politically. So who's going to be the one that could beat Brian Stile? So far in talking to people, there isn't a clear person. You go, oh, that person is a real challenger to Brian Stile, which underscores the real action is only in the 3rd District, Western Wisconsin. Rebecca Cook is again running against to challenge Derek Van Orden. She's got two primary challengers, but the interest is gravitating nationally toward Rebecca Cook. Bernie Sanders is going to be in Viroqua, I believe, next Saturday. To do a little rally with Rebecca Cook. And, of course, you know, all kinds of attacks from national Republicans about, you know, bringing a socialist into Western Wisconsin. But that's where the action is, right? Now, not saying that Cook's going to run the primary for sure, but a lot of attention. In the 1st, Brian Stile's got a lot of money in the bank. I think it was like more than $3.5 million last time I checked. Phenomenal fundraiser. Often outruns top of the ticket. It's not where the action is unless the bottom really drops out next year for Republicans. And if that happens, you want somebody who can ride the wave. Now, I'm not predicting a wave, mind you, in 2026. But if there is a wave, you can't beat somebody with nobody. You have to have somebody who's got a presence there. So Democrats will try and find somebody who's legitimate. Maybe one of these three guys is going to be it. Maybe somebody else gets in. But you want somebody there just in case at this point. And that's the way I'm viewing this race right now. It's a just-in-case race. The 3rd, for real. The 1st, just in case.
Yeah, I think, you know, nationally, Democrats always include the 1st in their sort of like 30 districts that we have to get. But to your point, the 3rd is always kind of considered like a toss-up or leans Republican, and the 1st is considered really likely Republican. Again, it's been Republican-held for about 30 years. Brian Stile handily has beaten his opponents the last couple of races, and to your point, is considered a really exceptional fundraiser and just has a strong presence there.
If there's a new map, you know, like anything is possible. We don't forget there's still two requests pending the Supreme Court to appoint a panel to hear these lawsuits, but that's not moving. Elections Commission has said many times we want new maps by April or March, no matter what you do. That clock is ticking, so barring new maps, yeah, it's going to be an uphill climb for Democrats.
Yeah, so we will see, but it does give us a little bit of exciting campaign news to keep an eye on, not just in the west of the state, but also the southeast. Speaking of south and eastern Wisconsin, huge floods this past weekend, state of emergency in Milwaukee County, and then statewide, there were severe storms over the weekend, continued into Sunday afternoon. No confirmed deaths, thank God, but flooding, structural damage, power outages, canceled the last day of the Wisconsin State Fair. A lot of attention, obviously, in Milwaukee County, but also up in Door County, there was pretty significant flood damage there, too. And so the governor ended up declaring a state of emergency. This is kind of our second big weather conversation in a couple of weeks. What does a state of emergency actually accomplish?
So this is part of a multi-step process to get federal help. So first, you're declaring a state of emergency. You're asking FEMA to do an assessment. You need to hit certain damage estimates or figure out how much damage you have to kind of qualify for various things. Then what happens next is, well, the president, and it's only the president's authority to declare, you know, this emergency, it's a disaster. That opens the door to all this kind of federal aid. Now, Governor Evers was in Milwaukee on Thursday, asked by reporters, you know, how's it going so far, and are you worried about politics playing a role in this decision? Because the president, you know, he's made some noise about California, for example, the wildfire stuff before, and there should be federal help. The governor said he hoped it wouldn't come to that, that this is the right thing to do. We need the help. The need is there, he said. So this is all part of a long process of trying to get people help, both local governments and homeowners, to kind of address what's going on.
Yeah, and we continue to see, you know, really kind of crazy video of people just needing to clear out their entire houses and all kinds of damage. And so I think it really will be a long cleanup process. Everyone I've spoken to this week, I call them for unrelated political, you know, news. And they're like, sorry, I took a while to call you back. My basement is still flooded or completely, you know, damaged. Last week, last Friday, when we last spoke, we were on veto watch. And I think I made a silly joke about not wanting to wait till 4:30 on Friday to hear what the governor was going to do. And he must have been watching, because yes, he signed all of his vetoes around 2:30, so we had a little bit more time. He vetoed 5 bills, and most kind of significantly was the portable benefits bill that we talked about for gig workers. That was kind of the highest profile one, but there were a couple of others as well. One that would have required agents from the Department of Correction to recommend revoking parole, one that would have restricted voting rights for people convicted of human trafficking-related crimes, direct primary care agreements, and one to establish a type of specialty courts. So what kind of jumps out to you from that list?
So the portable benefits bill we talked about before, that DoorDash dropped $1.4 million lobbying the Capitol, it shows that money doesn't always win in politics. The governor had concerns. He basically wrote his veto message that we reached out to lawmakers to try and have a conversation about this bill. They didn't heed my calls for a conversation. Ergo, this is not the way I want it done. Now, the Republican authors complained that the governor was basically not being very nice. 100,000 people in Wisconsin who do gig jobs. But this shows that, look, if you want something to get something done, you have to work with the governor's office to get things done. He's not going to compromise on a core values or something like the AFL-CIO saying, hey, we have a problem, because this bill would classify folks working for these gig jobs as not employees on things like unemployment insurance. So there's some issues there. Other ones like the parole violations, the governor's vetoed that before, not a surprise at all that he would do it again. The human trafficking and voting stuff, there are some people who are concerned that it was like a poll tax, essentially. The governor wrote the veto message, I'm not going to put up barriers to voting. So not any big shocks. And what I could see from what he did, and I don't think anything that would, we were surprised from what he did. Now, he did sign a number of bills also, like I think 15 or 16. The advanced practice registered nurses, he signed that one. He'd vetoed that twice before. The difference this time was the medical society was happy with it. So before it opposed it, and there are a couple reasons why. One, it's called title integrity or title protection. So I never say this word correctly, but an anesthetist who administers anesthesia during surgery is often a nurse, right? Anesthesiologist is doctor of anesthesia, right? If you are going to go and portray yourself as a doctor of anesthesia, that'd be a problem for the medical society. They want to make sure when you hang your shingle outside your clinic, you're not portraying yourself as something you're not. So there's title protection. Also, there are new requirements for hours worked in a clinic and training. So made the medical side at least neutral, and the governor signed that bill. So a showing of, like with the portable benefits one, they tried twice, the governor said no, they found compromise, said yes. So if you get AFL-CIO happy about the portable benefits bill, you might get it signed for the governor Lee's office.
Well, and to that point, you know, 2 years ago, last session, there was a more kind of overt attempt to reclassify independent contractors kind of across the board. Mm-hmm. And then this portable benefits legislation was like a little bit more of a subtle attempt to do that, because those who participate in the benefits sort of assent to being considered independent contractors. And so one of the things that Eever said in his veto message was, I object to the bill's definition of independent contractor status in the absence of any guaranteed benefit for workers. Changes to independent contractor definitions are a serious endeavor. And so that sort of raises the question, would he be open to those conversations about redefining workers and as an increasing percentage of people participate in the gig economy? What is that conversation around who is an independent contractor, who is an employee, who qualifies for things like workers' comp and unemployment insurance and all of that? So will they continue trying to craft legislation that a Democratic governor could sign off on?
And the window is getting very narrow, so believe it or not, there are actually 4 periods scheduled for this fall. I think they actually start in September. I'm not hearing a lot of like chatter about what they might do in the fall floor period. But outside of this fall, then you have next spring, which actually spring kind of ends in February in the Capitol. So you don't have much time. If you want to try and get this done before Evers leave office, you don't have much time. Now, you could bank on the idea of a new governor would be more open to this bill. So maybe wait till after the election next year, see how things go. But yeah, so there's your path if you want to get that thing done.
Yeah, so we will continue to kind of keep an eye on all of that. And that brings us to this week's stock report. Rising is a judge who got some exciting news.
Rebecca Taub is actually U.S. attorney, assistant U.S. attorney in Milwaukee, appointed to or nominated for the 7th Court of Appeals in Chicago. So here's the backstory. I can't remember a judge in Chicago in the 7th Circuit, but there are a couple seats reserved for Wisconsin justice. Diane Sykes, former state Supreme Court Justice of Wisconsin, was nominated by George W. Bush for that bench and confirmed back in the early aughts. And she's taking senior status October 1st. So now we have Rebecca Tableson. The president last night tweeted his support or posted on Truth Social that he was nominating her, how great she was. She's clerked for Brett Kavanaugh, Anton Scalia, how she's going to be a great judge. Now, the question is kind of how quickly will she become a judge? So the backstory of this whole thing is, Wisconsin has used a federal nominating commission since the 70s to identify candidates for federal appointments. So Senators Baldwin and Johnson created the commission again to identify candidates. She was one of the ones who was identified by the commission. That commission is designed, the way it's designed, kind of creates consensus picks, because there are 6 picks on the commission, 3 from each senator. You have to have 5 support you to become a candidate. Well, usually you don't get like kind of way far left, way far right, people emerging from that commission. So she kind of has that blessing of the both senators in a way, because she came out of the process that they both blessed. The same time, I reported back in May, the White House had begun a parallel process. They didn't want a consensus pick. They wanted somebody who would be a kind of a loyal conservative warrior, right? Like, think about Donald Trump. His first term, he relied on the Federal Society to kind of help him with picks. He's now turned on the Federalist Society, called, I think, Leo, the leader a sleazebag at one point, right, during the fall, the spring, because his own judicial picks were nixing his priorities in the courts. So he wants what he wants. Well, he began interviewing people outside of the commission process. She is one of them who was kind of getting early buzz in May that she was going to look at. So, okay, she gets both that process and the commission. So you think she's going to have an easy time, right? Maybe not easy, but probably a glide path to confirmation. It used to be if you were a senator, you had a blue slip that you could stop an appointment to the appeals court from your home state. Republicans in the first Trump administration ended that process. You could still do it for lower court picks, but not for appeals court. So Tammy Baldwin, even though she created the commission that produced these candidates, they included Rebecca, and sent it to the White House for not consideration, was a little cautious in her statement after the announcement was made, saying that she'll kind of look closer at credentials during the nomination or confirmation process. So now she goes to the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. What I'm watching for, a couple of things. One, Tableson clerked for Kavanaugh. She also defended Kavanaugh during the 2018 confirmation hearings. There's a video of an interview of her on CNN, which she called the questions about whether Kavanaugh would stick to precedent with Roe v. Wade as a red herring. obviously wasn't one. He voted to overturn it in 2022. Will she get any grief about that? We'll see. Can't forget Republicans. Certain members of the Republican umbrella don't like the FBI. Rebecca's husband worked for the FBI. Oh, horror that your spouse does something sometimes. But you never know. What I'm getting at is, look, Republicans, as I say unified, they're going to confirm this pick, right? So Democrats are going to raise concerns probably about the Kavanaugh stuff, maybe some other things. They can't stop the train. The wheels only come off if Republicans say, this is a problem for me. The president is enthusiastic about her. We've seen way more controversial picks than the president get confirmed by the Senate despite some concerns. So she looks pretty much on a glide path. But October 1st, when Diane Sykes goes to senior status, tough to get her done by October 1st. They're on recess until after Labor Day, so probably be after that. That's a big deal. When you take senior status, you just basically are semi-retired. You still hear cases, still getting paid, but you're not a full, true, like, active member of the court.
So that takes us to mixed, and that is Representative Tom Tiffany, whose name has been floated, obviously, for governor for quite a while. What's going on with him?
So he went on Up Front recently and said that he talked to the president about the race for governor. And the message was, I want to win the House, essentially. So now, what does that mean? That's been the kind of, what's that mean? Well, let's think big picture. Does Donald Trump care who the president or the governor is in Wisconsin come 2027? Not likely. Does he care who has the House? Absolutely. Why? Because if the Democrats flip the House, they can do hearings on his administration, they can do investigations, they could impeach him again. So he's very in tune to who has the House. Tom Tiffany's seat is not going to flip. The wave would have to be tsunami times three next year to flip the seventh. It's a very deep red district. Tiffany won with 66% of the vote last year. Okay, that's how red it is. At the same time, Trump, the White House, doesn't want a lot of drama. They don't want, one, to have, if Tiffany were to run for governor, to have a Freedom Caucus-type person replace him who'd be a pain in the butt for leadership, like some members are. Two, the drama of a contested primary. Those things get a little bit kind of hairy sometimes. Draws resources away from the real prize, which is the majority, so doesn't want that. So the president has talked out. Mike Lawler, New York, wants to run for governor, wanted to run for governor, talked him into staying in this House seat. He's given out very few endorsements. Byron Donald down in Florida, one of the few running for governor down there. He's been a loyal soldier for Trump. So they want no drama with the House. But would the president still endorse Tiffany if he got in? And would that be enough? So Tiffany's been making the argument, and people around him, that he's the one Republican talking about running who's most likely to have support of the MAGA crowd, right? No offense to Bill Berrien or Josh Shulman, but they don't have the same ties that Tiffany does to those voters, at least not yet. So Tiffany's made that pitch. We saw a poll, actually. Daily Caller, conservative outlet, had a poll late last night that I don't know who paid for it, but it's the president's pollsters saying that Tiffany's up by double digits in that primary, and if Trump were to endorse him, it'd grow to, like, a massive lead. Okay, so let's say Tiffany gets in. Will Trump endorse him? You know, probably. Would he lift a finger to help him? Maybe not, because he's from the House. But for Trump, if endorsement's enough to win the primary, at least. So we'll see how that plays out. One question is, why is Tiffany taking so long? At one point, it was going to be a summer decision. Now it's going to be a September decision. Why? Why does he keep pushing it back? Well, Tiffany's big red flag is his fundraising. Hasn't been a great fundraiser in his time in Congress or as a state senator. So he did have one contested race, a primary, back in 2020, the open seat. Maybe he's trying to line people up to get that, address that. Because if he does run, has a good report in January, that might address the issues that he's had with people going, I'm not sure about this guy. So that's kind of where we're at. People are expecting to get in eventually. And the question is when. Now, he might still say no, but the question is kind of like, when's he going to pull the trigger? And when he does, how quickly would a Trump endorsement come if it does come?
So lots to look at there. And then falling this week is the Joint Committee on Employee Relations, there we go, also known as Joker.
Yes. So for most of you at home, this doesn't mean a whole lot of anything. But this is kind of a big deal in how government works. So remember, the backstory is the Supreme Court the last year has kind of upended relationship between the legislative branch and executive branch. Last summer, for example, it said the Joint Finance Committee can't block stewardship purchases after approving the money in the budget. that you basically one kick at that cat. You approve the money for the program, you can't then block it afterward. They have said things like administrative rules. The Joint Committee of Administrative Rules can't indefinitely suspend rules going forward. It's kind of taking that oversight away. Now we have Joker. Joker, for the last 50 years, at least, under state statute, there's been a directive that once you do a pay plan, you must submit it to Joker for review. Now, it's kind of an arcane process. So the budget laid out pay increases of 3%, 2% for most state employees. It's in the budget. The money was put in called compensation reserves. It's there as a line item in the budget. It's not in agency budgets, though. I'll talk about that in a little bit. So you've approved the money, you've approved the raise, but you still go to Joker because the plan is not just the raise, it's the pay plan, the compensation plan, like who qualifies for things, what fringe benefits are, all these other kinds of things. Late last week, the Evers administration sent a memo through Division of Personnel Management. We are going to implement the pay raise, which is one piece of the pay plan, citing authority that we have confirmed by the governor's lawsuit against the legislature. That's the lawsuit that produced that joint finance decision on stewardship. This is a big deal, okay? Because, again, for 50 years plus, you've put that pay raise into the pay plan and submitted an entire document, 200 pages sometimes, to the committee for review. It came into play 2 years ago. Robin Voss, I'm the speaker's co-chair of Joker, he blocked pay raises for UW employees to then extract concessions from UW on DEI. Big deal, big power for them. That apparently is not going to be the case anymore. Your folks are saying, hey, how can you block a pay raise you've already funded and approved if you can't block a stewardship purchase? Now, if you're a Republican, you're not very happy about this. But what are your options? So if you want to sue about what the governor's done, you would go to Dane County Court. Probably not getting a very welcome reception in Dane County, shall we say. If you don't like that result, you'd appeal then up to the state Supreme Court, liberal majority. Do you want to risk the idea of possibility of having the state Supreme Court codify what the Evers stance is, that you guys can't stop us? Once you've approved the pay raise and funded it, we can go ahead and do this. Now, there's another step of the process. Remember, I talked about the pay raise and the pay plan. The pay plan, Evers folks tell me, they're still going to submit it to Joker. What I don't know yet is, will it be submitting it to him for approval or for, hey, here's an FYI, this is what we're doing? That would be an even bigger deal. So it's really fascinating to watch this kind of changing in the relationship between the executive branch and the legislative branch, what's going on. Just today, the Elections Commission, they had rules suspended by JCRAR about uniform absentee ballot standards. So if you go vote absentee, you might get different directions depending where you live. They wanted a rule saying these are the standards for everybody. That committee blocked it. Well, today they said, oh, wait a second. Since they had that ruling with JCRAR, we can start this process again. They approved going forward. So again, various examples of how the relationship has changed between the governor's office and the legislator and tilted the power toward the governor's office in these things.
Well, when we reported on that court case, you know, one of the quotes is about what a seismic effect this is going to have. And we kind of joked again about administrative rules. It doesn't sound like such a big deal. And now we are seeing this fallout just kind of consistently. And I, you know, I do have to disclose that this pay raise plan does affect me. I am a WPR employee. That means that I work for the University of Wisconsin. And so I am a state employee affected by that. So I do need to disclose that.
Yeah. That's a whole other piece of this puzzle. So with UW, it's a little bit different system. So UW sends, it requires, state law requires them to send the Board of Regents and the Chancellor of Madison campus their pay plans to Division of Personnel Management to then forward to Joker. So again, it's this whole kind of interesting web, and what's going to happen? That's the big question. How is this going to play out going forward?
And so we'll keep an eye on that, and that will do it for the week. I am Anjivan Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Thanks for watching.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.